With the latest in agriculture news from across the state and the country, it's Farm City Newsday. And here's your host, Sabrina Hill.
Good morning. Thanks for turning on the radio this morning. Today is Thursday, August 10th. Coming up in today's show, what can we expect from the NAFTA renegotiations? We'll get into that in just a moment, but first, the Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service is proposing to recognize Mexico as free of classical swine fever. The proposal replaces previous proposals by APHIS that would have recognized Mexico as a low-risk classical swine fever region. Since USDA's original proposal, Mexico has asked for enhanced evaluations by USDA. With results from the most recent site visits, USDA determined that the current conditions support classical swine fever-free recognition for all of Mexico. The newly proposed action would release classical swine fever restrictions on the importation of pork and pork products from Mexico, while continuing to protect the United States against the swine disease. APHIS is inviting public comments on the evaluation for 60 days. APHIS will then review and consider the comments received and make a final determination. Meanwhile, the pork industry is concerned that the new U.S. trade tensions with China could result in retaliation against U.S. farm sectors. National Pork Producer spokesperson Dave Warner says the Trump administration is right to deal with countries that discriminate against U.S. exports, just as it will in NAFTA talks starting this month.
But we want to make sure that whatever we do to correct problems doesn't jeopardize our own exports. And that's what the message we've made clear to the administration.
China says considering a retaliatory response, including against U.S. agriculture, if President Trump issues a memorandum directing the U.S. Trade Representative to investigate China's intellectual property and trade practices. Senate Democrats are also proposing legislation to crack down on trade abuses. Warner says China was the third best customer for U.S. pork last year.
We sent $1.1 billion of pork to China last year. And that was behind Japan, our number one, and Mexico, number two. So obviously very important market, and the potential for selling pork to China is tremendous.
The market includes well over a billion people, including a growing middle class that's moved to a protein diet.
So the potential is there, and we want to make sure we continue to have access to that market.
Farm interests continue to make that point to Congress and the administration in talks to update NAFTA. What are some of the objectives U.S. negotiators will have in modernizing the North American Free Trade Agreement in the context of ag trade? Rod Bain tells us.
The first round of the North American Free Trade Agreement renegotiations is fast approaching, with U.S. negotiators bringing their list of objectives for a modernized trade deal with Canada and Mexico to the table, including objectives for agriculture. At the top ag goods negotiation objective listed by the U.S. Trade Representative's office, maintaining existing reciprocal duty-free markets for farm and food goods, what several stakeholders like Randy Gordon of the National Grain and Feed Association sum up in this mantra.
Do no harm to U.S. agriculture. Preserve and build upon all market access and tariff concessions achieved for U.S. food and agriculture in the current NAFTA.
While expanding competitive market opportunities for individual U.S. commodities that currently have challenges entering into other NAFTA nations, as mentioned by Colorado Farm Bureau Federation President Don Shawcroft.
Such as tomatoes, potatoes, other fruits and vegetables, and sugar with Mexico, and the challenges for dairy, specialty and row crops, wheat, timber, lumber, and wine with Canada.
Many farm and food representatives agree with negotiation objectives that seek to eliminate non-tariff barriers, such as sanitary and phytosanitary measures and technical barriers to trade. And as William Westman of the North American Meat Institute notes, among those objectives are
creation of a rapid response mechanism, including tighter standards and deadlines for adverse import barriers.
Other U.S. negotiation objectives supported by several in the ag sector are summarized by Pat Binger of Cargill.
Customs and trade facilitation and enforcement and dispute settlement.
Aligning and streamlining various rules and regulations are also among the U.S. negotiation objectives for NAFTA. As expressed by Melissa San Miguel of the Grocery Manufacturers Association,
the United States should pursue all opportunities in NAFTA to concretely align regulations among the United States, Canada, and Mexico to decrease the costs associated with unnecessary regulatory differences. The agreement should include commitments to implement the highest standards for good regulatory practice and should advance regulatory coherence and cooperation.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
An updated book by the American Farm Bureau Federation for Agriculture offers a look at agriculture and food facts. Michael Clements has more.
Did you know that each American farm produces, on average, enough food and fiber for 165 people each year? That's one of the items featured in the new Food and Farm Facts book by the American Farm Bureau Foundation for Agriculture. The book offers consumers a look at facts about farming and food production. Editor of Food and Farm Facts, Cindy Shearing of the American Farm Bureau Federation, says it helps answer a lot of questions consumers have about their food.
The 32-page Food and Farm Facts book is full color and it features updated facts and easy-to-read infographics that can be used in a variety of different ways to help increase agricultural literacy. And Food and Farm Facts helps answer the questions such as, how do farmers and ranchers care for farm animals? Where does your food dollar go? Where does our food come from? And who grows it?
She says the book helps fulfill a need of providing consumers the information they want about their food.
Farm Bureau puts out Food and Farm Facts because we know that consumers have a lot of questions about their food that they eat and where it comes from. So we're hoping to answer that by providing information in an easy-to-use format with colorful illustrations about today's farmers and what they're doing on their farms and ranches.
The book, along with other resources, is available now.
You can order online at the American Farm Bureau Foundation for Agriculture's website, and it's very simple to order. You can take a look at what's available and the different products and get what you need, and we hope that everyone will take a look and order today.
The book is available online on the American Farm Bureau Foundation for Agriculture website at www.agfoundation.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. I'm your host, Sabrina Hill. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
It's time to rethink what you know about clean American propane and what it can do for your operation. Want efficient, reliable power independent of the grid? Propane can do that. Power for EPA-compliant engines without all the extra fluids and filters? Propane can do that. Eliminate fuel theft. Lower hourly fuel costs. Reduce downtime. Propane can do all of that. Discover all the things propane can do on your farm at propanecandothat.com.
Attention, California citrus growers, production managers, industry professionals. The 26th annual Citrus Expo in Fort Myers, Florida is proud to host U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sunny Perdue on August 16th, the first day of the show. Make plans now to attend the 26th annual Citrus Expo on August 16th and 17th for an opportunity to mingle with Secretary Perdue on the trade show floor. The latest in citrus research and data will also be presented at over a dozen seminars. Don't wait. Pre-register now at citrusexpo.net.
Okay, Mike is calling from Davenport. Go ahead, Mike. You're on Soil Talk.
The engine isn't performing like it should, and I'm wondering what's going on.
All right, couple of questions, Mike. Do you have high porosity in aggregates? Is there a porous medium for gas exchange?
I don't know.
Well, hey, look, Mike, if you want performance, you got to find out if it's good under the hood, huh?
Okay, how?
Stop by your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today, Mike. They can help you supercharge your soil and get that engine cranking it out for you.
Hey, we're out of time, Mike. Hey, thanks for your call. Gotta go. Thanks, everyone, for listening to Soil Talk.
Find out what you can do to maximize your farm's production engine. It's soil. Through soil health management systems, you can lower input costs, increase yields, and drought protect your farm. Stop by your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. Brought to you by NRCS and this radio station.
This is Farm City Newsday. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. We'll be right back with more of the news that's important to you.
The California Association of Food Banks Farm to Family Program helps growers and packers recoup costs for products that may otherwise go unused. The program takes secondary products or excess fruits and vegetables from the field to your local food bank and beyond. Many growers and packers receive reimbursement for picking and pack-out costs in addition to receiving a California state tax credit. Join the more than 100 growers and packers who already participate in Farm to Family. Visit cafoodbanks.org to learn more. That's cafoodbanks.org. Farm to Family. Good for families, good for farmers.
Welcome back to Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's Brian German.
After an exceptionally wet winter, the California rice harvest may be dealing with a time crunch this fall. The heavy rains that continued well into spring caused many growers to shift their planting schedule by up to a month. President and CEO of the California Rice Commission, Tim Johnson, noted that harvest season will also see some adjustments.
Talking with our growers in the last couple of weeks, it's really uncertain about the timing of harvest. It certainly will be a more compressed harvest season, and if we get late cool weather or early rains in the fall, then that would push harvest back.
Some fields weren't planted this year due to the amount of water that was still standing in fields late into the planting season.
Our acreage this year will be impacted by the heavy rains and the flooding that we saw in the Sacramento Valley. Our latest estimates are around 460,000 acres of rice for this year. So a pretty significant reduction off of last year's crop.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West.
A new report shows that Dean Foods Company is struggling amid slowing milk sales and rising costs. The news comes as Dean's largest customer, Walmart Stores, is preparing to open its own milk processing plant, reducing its reliance on Dean. The Texas-based milk supplier this week cut its per-share profit expectations nearly in half. Shares of Dean Foods are now down 45% this year, and the company's CEO has pledged to reduce annual expenses by up to $50 million in 2018. The Wall Street Journal says Dean's recent struggles, however, raised broader questions among some analysts on payoffs from the milk company's long-term strategy to focus investment on branded milk products. Meanwhile, retailers have added to the price pressure by aggressively pushing for cheaper milk for their own store brands. Walmart's soon-to-be-open milk plant in Indiana will cost Dean about 90 million to 95 million gallons worth of sales annually. Dean says it has been preparing for that shift.
Well, in today's livestock news, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke has announced a new plan to manage sage-grouse in 11 western states. He said the new protocol would go into effect immediately and the new policy supersedes the Obama administration's rules. Now, the change came from a report by a sage-grouse task force that Zinke had established. He said the administration will offer states flexibility in how they choose to protect the bird and also will loosen restrictions on energy development in sage-grouse habitat. According to the Hagstrom Report, environmental and animal protection groups denounced the Trump administration as weakening the attempt to increase the sage-grouse population and a gift to the oil and gas industry. Now, the Public Lands Council and National Cattlemen's Beef Association issued a statement after that release. According to PLC President Dave Eliason, in that release, he said, during an initial review of the report, I was encouraged by several key priorities, including the compatibility of proper grazing management and conservation. He said the report acknowledges the need for a more collaborative approach between grazing permittees and federal leadership, as well as a reexamination of the habitat objectives table and its application, both key elements to successful conservation efforts for the greater sage grouse. He said the report also reinforced the need to pursue outcome-based grazing demonstration projects and target grazing pilot projects, two critical tools for the responsive management of ecosystems and fuel loads. Well, a new report shows the Dean Foods Company is struggling amid slowing milk sales and rising costs. That news comes as Dean's largest customer, Walmart, is preparing to open its own milk processing plant, reducing its reliance on Dean. The Texas-based milk supplier this week cut its per-share profit expectations nearly in half. Shares of Dean Foods are down 45% this year, and the company's CEO has pledged to reduce annual expenses by up to $50 million by 2018. The Wall Street Journal says Dean's recent struggles raise broader questions among some analysts on payoffs from the milk company's long-term strategy to focus investment on branded milk products. Meanwhile, retailers have added to the price pressure by aggressively pushing for cheaper milk for their own store brands. Walmart's soon-to-be-open milk plant in Indiana will cost Dean between 90 and 95 million gallons worth of sales annually, but Dean announced that they have been preparing for the shift. And Cargill announced this week that they have reached an agreement to acquire the animal feed business of Southern States Cooperative. Withholding terms of the deal, Cargill released a statement last week saying it expects the transaction to close within 90 days. Cargill said the transaction will better serve its customers in the U.S. and is part of the company's feed and nutrition's growing strategy. Now, under the agreement, Cargill will purchase the assets of Southern States Cooperative's animal feed business that includes seven feed mills and a portfolio of products, brands, and customer and supplier relationships. The other segments of Southern States Cooperative business, which includes retail, farm supply, energy, and agronomy, are not part of the transaction. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Everett Greiner is next.
Well, finally, here's some positive news about honeybees. We lost fewer colonies of bees last year than in 2015. Matter of fact, the survey showed that the number of lost colonies to insects and disease has been in a slow decline since the original devastation 10 years ago. The answer is better care and a stronger bee. But there's still no cure for colony collapse disorder. Beekeepers are also doing a better job of caring for their hives. This was an in-depth study done by well-qualified researchers. The survey included almost 5,000 beekeepers and covered over 250,000 hives. Now, that's a big number. But members of the study group say more work is needed. One said, "We're not out of the woods, but we know a lot more than we did before. And the research will go on." And that's Ag Review for today. Everett Greiner, AgNet West.
Specialty Crop News, brought to you by the Almond Board of California. Find them online at almonds.com. There are some important guidelines when stockpiling almonds in order to control aflatoxins. I talked with Almond Board Director of Quality Assurance and Industry Services, Tim Birmingham, to get details.
Yeah, so the main thing that growers need to be concerned about during harvest in regards to aflatoxin is controlling moisture to make sure that the almonds are not stockpiled at elevated moistures, which could then lead to increased humidity in the stockpiles and mold growth that could lead to aflatoxin development.
So what are some good ways to handle this, the moisture control?
Yeah, so the main thing for controlling the moisture is to make sure that the almond kernels are less than 6% moisture. That typically equates to about a 9% total fruit if you're looking at the almond hulls and the kernels combined. But really at the hulls only to make sure it's less than 12%. So there's a number of things that growers want to do at the time of harvest to make sure that they're within these ranges. I think the main thing is to really look at the forecast, and if rain is in the forecast, you really shouldn't shake the nuts at that time. You want to make sure they're, if possible, that you can avoid those nuts being on the ground when it's going to rain, which could then cause elevated moisture, could lead to problems down the road. Now, if you've already shaken and the nuts are on the ground and it has rained, what you want to do as soon as you can is to get into those stockpiles and you want to condition those nuts. So you want to turn the stockpiles. You want to make sure that the nuts themselves aren't close to the trees where you're going to have elevated moistures. But you also want to make sure they're not windrowed where you could have a big pile of wet nuts that takes a long time to dry out. So you really want to make sure you condition those nuts to try to get them to those moistures where the kernel is less than 6% moisture or the total in-haul or the total haul moisture is less than 12%. Or when the hauler sellers are building those stockpile, there's a number of things that they can do to help minimize the potential for aflatoxin development in the stockpile. The first thing they want to do is they want to make sure that they're picking a location that is either slightly sloped or up on a hill. Make sure you're not going to have pooling of water in that area, which could then lead to increased humidity. Once they start building those stockpiles, they want to orientate them in a north to south orientation. And that's going to help to also minimize potential condensation once they put the tarps on. Then when you do put the tarps on, you want to make sure you're using a tarp material that's going to minimize condensation formation. And really what we found that is the best is for a stockpile is a white on black tarp. And that will help to minimize temperature fluctuations, which could lead to the condensation and then the mold growth. And then also the tops of those stockpiles should be relatively flat. You don't want big peaks and valleys because the valleys will, if you do have condensation, the water will collect in those valleys and that could lead to elevated humidity or moisture right in those valleys, which then could cause hot pockets for mold growth. So those are really the main things. The one thing that you want to really pay attention to when you build those stockpiles and when you put the tarps on is the actual humidity in the stockpile. And we have a chart in our stockpile management guidelines, which helps those folks who are dealing with stockpiles understand when it becomes a potential concern as far as elevated moisture. And when the moisture and relative humidity increase above about 65%, that's when some corrective actions need to take place. And typically, what the corrective actions will involve is venting of the stockpile periodically to try to release some of that elevated moisture content from the stockpile. So when you look at the chart, you can clearly equate what you have in your stockpile. So if you're measuring the moisture and humidity, you can then go back and take a look at the chart that we have in our stockpile management guideline, and it shows whether or not you should be venting those stockpiles. You know, and again, typically when the stockpile is reaching 65% or higher on the humidity, that's really when you want to get in there and start to vent that to make sure you're getting rid of some of that moisture. Those are really the main things that you should be doing as a grower or a hauler sheller to control moisture, which again is going to help with the mold and controlling that mold growth, which could lead to aflatoxin development.
And where can we find these guidelines?
So these guidelines are all available on the Almond Board website. So if you go to almonds.com and you go to the grower site, you can find these under Producing a Safe Product. And again, they're called the Stockpile Management Best Practices Guide.
Almond Board Director of Quality Assurance and Industry Services, Tim Birmingham. This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. We'll be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
It's time to rethink what you know about clean American propane and what it can do for your operation. Want efficient, reliable power independent of the grid? Propane can do that. Power for EPA-compliant engines without all the extra fluids and filters? Propane can do that. Eliminate fuel theft. Lower hourly fuel costs. Reduce downtime. Propane can do all of that. Discover all the things propane can do on your farm at propanecandothat.com.
Attention, California citrus growers, production managers, industry professionals. The 26th annual Citrus Expo in Fort Myers, Florida is proud to host U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sunny Perdue on August 16th, the first day of the show. Make plans now to attend the 26th annual Citrus Expo on August 16th and 17th for an opportunity to mingle with Secretary Perdue on the trade show floor. The latest in citrus research and data will also be presented at over a dozen seminars. Don't wait. Pre-register now at citrusexpo.net.
Okay, Mike is calling from Davenport. Go ahead, Mike. You're on Soil Talk.
The engine isn't performing like it should, and I'm wondering what's going on.
All right, couple of questions, Mike. Do you have high porosity in aggregates? Is there a porous medium for gas exchange?
I don't know.
Well, hey, look, Mike, if you want performance, you got to find out if it's good under the hood, huh?
Okay, how?
Stop by your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today, Mike. They can help you supercharge your soil and get that engine cranking it out for you.
Find out what you can do to maximize your farm's production engine. It's soil. Through soil health management systems, you can lower input costs, increase yields, and drought protect your farm. Stop by your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office today.
The California Association of Food Banks Farm to Family Program helps growers and packers recoup costs for products that may otherwise go unused. The program takes secondary products or excess fruits and vegetables from the field to your local food bank and beyond. Many growers and packers receive reimbursement for picking and pack-out costs, in addition to receiving a California state tax credit. Join the more than 100 growers and packers who already participate in Farm to Family. Visit cafoodbanks.org to learn more. That's cafoodbanks.org. Farm to Family. Good for families, good for farmers.
Your Beef Checkoff does all kinds of things to help make sure consumers feel good about buying beef, like researching the health benefits of beef and sharing this news with healthcare professionals, or discovering new lean cuts of beef like the Denver cut steak, which fits an active lifestyle, or sharing the good news about these new beef products and cuts with chefs, grocers, and consumers. Get to know your checkoff and start sharing your views at mybeefcheckoff.com. Paid for by the Beef Checkoff.
Welcome back to Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Now more of the agriculture stories you'll want to know today. The U.S. Virgin Islands is one of the last two U.S. territories that is seeking to join the U.S. Drought Monitor System. Stephanie Ho has more on the story.
Tourists are presented a picture of the U.S. Virgin Islands as a tropical paradise of green hills, beautiful beaches, and sparkling blue water.
Boy, Virgin Islands nice. So nice.
However, if you're one of more than 100,000 residents, you know that your Caribbean island homeland is not always as verdant as people might think.
I was going to say, even as a local, like living there, I've noticed it getting hotter and like it doesn't rain as quite as often as it used to when I was younger.
We were talking to some farmers a few weeks ago, and he was talking to us about how it seems like every year he has to use even more and more water for his crops because rain doesn't fall as much as it used to.
That was Asil Mustafa and Colwyn Morton, two students from the University of the Virgin Islands who were on a summer internship at USDA. Morton is working with weather experts to gather data to back up anecdotes like these and put the U.S. Virgin Islands onto the drought monitor map.
One of the reasons the Virgin Islands hasn't really been on the map is due to a lack of data. If you look at the weather station data, we have lots of gaps. It's not very consistent. So what I've been doing so far is gathering about 30 years' worth of data.
Why is he worried about the old data?
Because we need to find some kind of standard. Like, you know, to find out whether a place is in drought or not, we need to know, like, what's the normal precipitation value for that area.
When the drought monitor was initially created and devised and produced in the late 90s, at that time, we incorporated the lower 48 states plus Alaska, Hawaii, and Puerto Rico.
That was USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
And a catalyst for adding especially the Virgin Islands was the historic drought of 2015, which caused a lot of agricultural problems and water supply issues for the U.S. Virgin Islands.
At that time, since the Virgin Islands was not part of the drought monitor system, the government resorted to using newspaper articles and photos of starving livestock to persuade USDA officials to make a drought declaration. To help the U.S. Virgin Islands systematically collect the data it needs to join the drought monitor, Morton says he has helped set up new weather stations around the islands.
The funnest part of the whole thing is probably the installation. I get to climb on top of roofs. I climb on top of groups of churches and houses and schools. And basically, it's about the size of a football, and it has a sonar panel on it.
Morton says 14 weather stations were installed in the last year. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says he is optimistic.
Our goal here at USDA is to try to put the Virgin Islands on the U.S. Drought Monitor map by the end of this calendar year or very early in 2018.
We got so much to lose, got so much to prove.
Rippey adds that a similar effort is going on to get the U.S.-affiliated Pacific Islands onto the drought monitor map as well. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Americans are eating more blackberries than ever before. Gary Crawford has a report that may offer some reasons for the recent surge in consumption.
And now, here's an old-time song miss, about our spotlighted food for today.
Blackberry boogie.
Blackberry boogie.
I brought back like a flip when it's
blackberry picking time. I gotta learn more of the words to that song.
That's all right, don't bother.
Okay.
The augmented vocals there from Laura Popilski. I'm with her once again in the vegetation tent of the Agriculture Department's Farmers Market in Washington, where farmers are selling blackberries. Laura is talking about them. So, Laura, what's the botanical name for the blackberry? You don't know, so what should I do?
Go and connect with a betologist.
Oh, a betologist. Isn't that someone who studies Batman?
Betology is the study of blackberries.
You mean there are people who just study blackberries?
There are. And they're doing hard work
on their blackberries, no doubt. Turns out, blackberries and others in that family are called brambles. Botanists study brambles, but most of us shoppers want to avoid the brambles, just buy the berries at the store or from the farmer's market. And how do we choose the best ones?
Hopefully you're finding ones that are nice and shiny and plump looking. If you get any that look kind of mushy or not that nice, deep, rich color, you don't want those.
So if you do choose a good batch, you store them in the fridge, right?
And they will last in your fridge for about 2 or 3 days, so you'll want to eat them up real soon.
Or freeze them. They'll keep for about 8 months. The story of blackberries' rapid rise in this country is remarkable. 20 years ago, commercial shipments of blackberries were just a few thousand pounds. Today, they're up to over 180 million pounds. One reason may be some research showing blackberries have large amounts of antioxidants.
And studies are finding that there may be a link between antioxidants and fighting cancer.
Plus, blackberries have vitamin C and potassium. But Laura, why do you eat them?
Because they have such a lovely flavor.
Now we get to the truth. You're out here showing some ways to take advantage of that flavor.
What we're doing here today at the market is making a blackberry compote. So we're blending up the berries And then we're going to add a little bit of honey, a little bit of lemon juice.
Oh, wow.
And we're going to drizzle this sauce on some shortbread cookies.
Oh, that's nice. Or you can drizzle it on things like grilled pork, chicken, or... speaking of drizzling, starting to rain here. So, Laura, you said you had a joke for us. You better go ahead with it.
What do you get when you eat a blackberry? A Bluetooth.
Ooh, a little technology joke there. Very little one.
What about this one?
I don't know. I haven't heard it yet.
Why were all the little blackberries crying?
Oh.
Because their parents were in a jam.
That's pretty bad.
It is pretty bad.
Oh, rain's getting bad here, too. I'm glad we're in a tent here. For some great blackberry recipes, go online to What's Cooking USDA. What's Cooking USDA and search blackberry.
Blackberry boogie. I'll be back, little gal, when it's blackberry picking time.
Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington. Ooh, the rain's coming down.
The Department of Agriculture says almond growers were the top users of pollination services in 2016. Farmers growing crops that depend on pollination can rely on wild pollinators in the area or pay beekeepers to provide honeybees and other managed bees, such as the blue orchard bee. In 2016, U.S. farmers paid $354 million for pollination services. USDA says producers of almonds alone account for 80% of that amount, more than $280 million. By comparison, producers of apples and blueberries paid about $10 million each. Pollination services help support the production of these crops, which in 2016 had a total production value of about $5.2 billion for almonds, $3.5 billion for apples, and $720 million for blueberries. Over the same period, the number of honey-producing colonies grew by 14%. For more on any of the stories you've heard here this morning, visit our website at agnetwest.com. You can also find us on Twitter at agnetwest or myself at Sabrina W. Hill. This has been Farm City News Day by Agnet West, and I am your host, Sabrina Hill. Have a wonderful day.